No cable, just streaming. It's a queue on the screen all weekend. Pick a right click, can't go wrong. Gonna watch Netflix all night long. No cable, just streaming. It's a queue on the screen all weekend. Pick a right click, can't go wrong. Gonna watch Netflix all night long.
Leaving from the club just so I can watch my flicks.
Netflix presents a Netflix original podcast produced by Netflix and starring Netflix in the lead role. Filmbookcast, the official podcast of Filmbook.com, a subsidiary of Netflix. I'm Mike Netflix Smith, and joining me as always is my Amazon Prime.
Mike Amazon Prime DiCriscio?
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm a little weary that I have to be Amazon, although I don't know, I guess I'll take it. They're doing all right.
You're the rival streaming service. Like I listed you as the chief competitor in Netflix. Amazon Prime is probably their biggest competitor, I would say, right, in terms of streaming.
I would say so.
Who else would you say? Would you rather I said like Mike Crackle DiCriscio? Is that who you want to be, Mike? You want to be Crackle?
But that would mean that Jerry Seinfeld just left me, so no, I think I'm good.
For Netflix, mind you.
Yeah, true. The one thing I had going for me is gone.
Yeah, we should say we're not actually a subsidiary of Netflix. That's probably...
I was going to say, this might get into some weird... let's clear that up right quick.
Yeah, we are not actually a subsidiary of Netflix. We are reviewing a Netflix original film today, and I thought it was funny that when I started the movie, it said Netflix presents a Netflix original film.
Yeah.
Without crediting the director of the movie or anything. So I just thought that was entertaining to me and thus entertaining to the listeners of this podcast.
So why not enter into a legal gray area and say that?
Yeah. Well, if you've never listened to Filmbookcast before, that's what we do. We enter legal gray areas every episode.
Yep.
But before we do that, we usually start with some film news and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we will move on to our featured review this week. It is the newest film from director Charlie McDowell and the latest in a long line of films picked up for distribution at Sundance by Netflix, The Discovery. Are you excited to talk about The Discovery, Mike?
Yeah. I think this is going to have lots of interesting stuff for us to talk about.
Yeah, I think so too. And you know, normally, like, we were talking about what movies we're going to review this week, and we threw out a lot of options over the past few weeks, right? We were saying like we could review Beauty and the Beast, we could review Trainspotting 2, we could review Life, we could review this other thing. I forget what else we were talking about.
Ghost in the Shell.
It was an option.
Which I think is the reason we didn't see it, because you forgot already.
Fair enough. We were throwing out a lot of different movies. We did not mention The Discovery once. So, sorry, listeners who went out to go see Ghost in the Shell on the off chance that we would review it so you could listen to it. Of which I'm sure there are several. We did review The Discovery, which you can watch very easily because it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It costs exactly $0.
Well, it costs $8.99 a month or whatever the...
Okay. Well, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. But anyway, so we will be reviewing The Discovery in just a little bit. Before we get into that, let's get into some film news. Let's get into some film news starting right now on Film Bookcast, and we have a lot to get through today, Mike, so let's start off with this relatively big one. Sylvester Stallone has left the Expendables franchise, Mike.
No!
That beloved franchise that we all hold so dear to our hearts. Truly, he was expendable. He lived right up to the name. This was surprising to me for a couple of reasons. I mean, there have been three Expendables movies, and I guess they were trying to get a fourth one off the ground,
right?
I have not seen any of the Expendables films, and you know, it seems like these would be something that would be like right up my alley, right? Like I love action movies and I love everybody in that cast. The cast of these Expendable movies is insane. There's like Stallone and Jason Statham and like Jet Li's in there, Terry Crews.
Schwarzenegger.
Liam Hemsworth too, I guess, but you know, whatever.
I guess, sure. Dolph Lundgren. It's Dolph everyone Lundgren, that yeah. ever was in a movie yeah. in the 80s, basically.
Bruce Willis is there. Yeah, it's a nuts cast. They're basically just like throwback 80s action movies, supposedly. But the reviews for these movies are always terrible. Like, they're always they're always pretty bad. I remember I was thinking about going to see the first Expendables around the time it came out. but it opened on the same weekend as Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I saw that movie 3 times in theaters.
Yeah, young baby Mike Smith had no choice in that weekend.
I had no time for the Expendables. I was too busy watching Scott Pilgrim over and over again. So I just never got onto the Expendables train. But the whole thing about this franchise is that Stallone is the star, right? Stallone is the guy who got these movies made. He's the one who like brought them all together. He's the one who brought this cast together. These are Sylvester Stallone's movies, and now he's leaving. And it's surprising. Like, I don't know if they're going to try to continue the franchise without him. Like, do you think that's something that could happen? I mean, I feel like these Expendables movies are something that nobody really cares about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I have seen the first two. I think I even saw all 3 of them. I don't even remember.
Really?
I don't remember if I've seen the 3rd one. But, yeah, they're fun. Like, make some popcorn at home and watch stuff explode while old men make one-liner jokes. Pretty much. It's I think you would love them, actually. They are the things you love about movies. But they are definitely a Sylvester Stallone vehicle for what like this franchise. So it'll be interesting to see if they make more. I don't know if they particularly make a lot of money in theaters, but in terms of box office and stuff.
They must have done well. They made 3 of them.
I guess so, yeah. You're right.
And that can't be like a cheap cast either. That's got to be a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. It feels like these exist because of his force of will and that he wants them to happen. So with him gone, I assume they won't make more.
Yeah.
And it will, you know, not that it would affect the story because the story is as threadbare as you would assume for these kinds of movies.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it also feels like maybe he realized that he can be in good movies too. Like, you know, he made Creed a couple years ago and like that movie was incredible. Like he got a lot of critical acclaim for that. So maybe he's like, oh, maybe I should just keep doing movies that people like instead. And he's also joining the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which is insane. And he's going to be in the new Olivier Assayas movie, who's a great indie director. So, you know, maybe Stallone's on like a career resurgence in terms of critical acclaim.
And it all came about because he started the Expendables.
Yeah,
I'll take that hot take right now.
Yeah, fair enough. So I did want to mention that briefly. And now let's move on to the next bit of film news. This is actually TV news, so it's a little off topic, but we'll let it slide.
Yeah, it's close enough.
Deadwood creator David Milch, who also created shows like Luck, John from Cincinnati, he works in NYPD Blue, one of the great TV auteurs, I think. And somebody who doesn't work that often either. And supposedly he's been working on a Deadwood follow-up movie for the last several years. I mean, pretty much since Deadwood ended, people have been like, well, where's the follow-up to this? Because it was canceled pretty unceremoniously and kind of left a lot of dangling threads. Mm-hmm. I've only seen the first season of Deadwood, mind you. I should watch seasons 2 and 3. I've heard they're very good. Season 1 is very good. It stands to reason that 2 and 3 are very good as well.
There you go.
But I loved Luck. Luck was a great show. I don't know if you ever watched Luck. But
that's the horse racing one, right?
That is the horse racing one, which was canceled after 1 season because all the horses died. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it was a great show.
That's what I've heard. I haven't seen Luck.
But anyway, so David Milch, who created all these shows, one of the best TV writers out there, is supposedly co-writing True Detective Season 3 with Nick Pizzolatto, the creator of True Detective, which is like, what?
Yeah, I haven't seen Deadwood or Luck, as I said before. But I have heard, obviously, tremendous things about both of them.
Yeah.
And True Detective Season 1 is one of my favorite things that's ever happened on TV. I was, I think, one of the fewer people that enjoyed Season 2.
I definitely was not one of the people who enjoyed Season 2. So
yeah, it definitely wasn't great, but I was okay with it, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think True Detective Season 2, like HBO has said, and I think Nick Pizzolatto has also said, that they made mistakes in Season 2 because they rushed Nick Pizzolatto into getting it written.
Right.
Because Season 1 was such a success.
Yeah, I mean, he had however long it took him to write Season 1 and then a year to write Season 2.
Right.
So.
And for some people are able to do that. Nick Pizzolatto wasn't able to get his ideas formulated quite as easily. Plus, I mean, he lost Cary Fukunaga, who directed all of Season 1. And I think that was a big blow for Season 2 as well. But now Season 3, you've got David Milch co-writing and Nick Pizzolatto writing. Like, that's a really enticing combination. I have like the thing about them both is that they're both incredibly intense personalities, and I'm not sure how well they will get along writing this thing.
That's a good point, yeah.
But I am eager to see what these two create if this indeed comes to pass. Like, a True Detective Season 3 was something that I wasn't even sure would ever happen, because Season 2 was so, like, critically reviled. You know,
yeah.
And it was bad. Like, it was a bad... not to disparage something that you enjoyed under the bus, but like it is a rough season of TV.
You're not wrong.
With some bright moments, there's some good moments in season two. I will totally say that. Like, for every meandering plot point that didn't make any sense, there may have been one like beautiful image that I was like, oh, kind of captivated by. But season two overall, I'm not really a fan of. True Detective season three, I was kind of hesitant about, but now that David Milch is involved, like, this is intriguing.
And I feel like HBO has been pretty radio silent on whether or not they were going to even go ahead with the season three until this news. So this is it's exciting that this is it's possible, and this might be the team with it. So
there you go. Very cool. And then there is some more news to get through. Recently, we've been talking about a lot of John Carpenter remakes that are in the works, Mike. I don't know if you've picked up on that pattern. but I feel like I think it was last year we talked about the Big Trouble in Little China remake that's in the works with The Rock. Haven't really heard much about that yet in a little while. But just a few weeks ago, I feel like we were talking about Danny McBride and David Gordon Green writing a new Halloween movie.
which is still an insane sentence.
Which is still insane. But now we can add another to the list of John Carpenter remakes, because Robert Rodriguez is attached to remake Escape from New York. And, man, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I feel like initial thoughts were, yeah, and then immediately, meh.
Yeah, well, apparently John Carpenter is supposedly executive producing this remake, but we don't know how hands-on he'll be.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, Escape from New York is, I don't think it's a very good movie. A lot of people hail it as one of Carpenter's best. I don't think it's quite up there for me, but it is a really well-regarded movie. Like, people really like Escape from New York. And Robert Rodriguez has not made a good movie in a really long time.
And I feel like Rodriguez's like big silly that's not even true, because Carpenter also did that.
Sure,
I don't know,
but that's not Escape from New York, though. Escape from New York is this really like gritty, grounded thriller,
right?
You know, Escape from LA is big silly nonsense. Yeah.
I didn't even need to finish the sentence and he knew where I was going. But yeah, so I hope Rodriguez can stop, you know, like, whenever I think of Rodriguez, I think of the machine gun leg from Planet Terror. And
right.
I know that's a very specific grindhouse, like, they were doing a thing with him and Tarantino, and like, that's why it's that silly and crazy. But that's what I think of. I think of Machete. Like, I think of these ridiculous movies.
Yeah.
That I don't know if John Carpenter's thrillers mesh well with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't know if this will ever actually happen. I think Robert Rodriguez is currently making Alita: Battle Angel, which is the old movie that James Cameron was supposed to be making a while ago, and he passed it on to Rodriguez. So we'll see if this actually happens. I don't know if it will. Because, again, that Big Trouble in Little China remake is still just sitting there. We haven't heard much about that for quite a while, so... you know, we'll see what happens. Whatever. Maybe John Carpenter will do the music, like he's doing for Halloween. Probably.
Oh, man, that'd be cool, I guess.
So I did want to mention that. And then also I wanted to mention, last time we did a film bookcast, we talked about how Sony is developing a Venom movie that would spin off of their Spider-Man universe. And now it's been revealed that in addition to Venom, Sony is also developing a Black Cat / Silver Sable Spider-Man spinoff, which seems even more pointless than than a Venom movie. I gotta say,
yeah.
I mean, so you're somebody who reads comics, but is not like engulfed in comics, right? Like you're somebody who, and I would say I'm probably the same way. I know a lot about Spider-Man characters specifically, so this seems like it should be right up my alley. But like I know who Black Cat is. I barely know who Silver Sable is. I'm not even sure if I actually do know who Silver Sable is.
Black Cat is a character I have heard of. Silver Sable, those are just words. You can't just make up a character, Mike.
I thought I would trick you. No. and I mean, on the one hand, I kind of like I appreciate that maybe Sony's trying to do like this female-driven spinoff, like that could be interesting. But at the same time, it still just feels like. I feel like they're looking a gift horse in the mouth with this, with these Spider-Man spinoffs. You know, you have been granted access to the Marvel Universe. And they're right. And they're trying to throw it away with these like other like Spider-Man spinoffs that can't use the Marvel Universe. And it's like, what are you doing? And now it's they're saying that there was a some Sony executive was saying maybe like whatever 4 or 5 movies from now they might take Spider-Man back and rescind him from the Marvel Universe. And it's like, why would you even say that before Spider-Man Homecoming, the first Spider-Man solo movie, comes out? You know, it's
that'd be the worst idea Sony ever had if they revoked the rights for that.
Yeah, that would be insane. And I did also actually want to mention that since we're talking about Spider-Man stuff, Venom. A little more details have been revealed about what that movie's going to be like. Apparently, they want to make it like an R-rated horror movie. And I like the idea behind that. But it also feels like they're chasing the coattails of Deadpool and Logan in that regard, you know?
Definitely. I mean, Venom, I think, from what I know, which is just like the 90s Spider-Man cartoon of Venom, because I haven't read any comics with him in it. But it seems like that type of character would work for that kind of R-rated horror, body horror, grotesque type of like movie, which seems cool. But it definitely, I think this, like you said, is going to be the trend for people trying to cash in on Snyderverse R-rated, like gritty.
Let's not say Snyderverse because Snyder hasn't done that yet. Done the R-rated.
That's true. Cut. That's true. That's a good point.
There is like the director's cut of Batman for Superman, but I'm not sure. Is that rated R or is that like unrated?
I don't know. I haven't followed up on that.
But it doesn't matter. Like theatrically, you could say it's the Foxverse. That is
the Foxverse. You're right. Rated there R. You go.
But yeah. So who knows what'll happen with that? I mean, you know, I think in terms of a Venom movie. If Sony can somehow go back in time and get David Cronenberg to do it in the 80s, then I would be all in on the on this Venom thing. Speaking of Cronenberg, did you end up getting to watch the new Rick and Morty?
I did. Yes, I did. Yes.
Wasn't it so good?
That might be their best episode of all time so far.
It was fucking amazing.
I love it.
So that's just a brief aside about the new Rick and Morty. If you haven't watched it yet, go watch it.
I think more of our episodes could use brief asides about Rick and Morty, Mike. It should be the new Marvel. We'll just talk about it for hours.
That's probably true. The Rick and Morty cast.
Yes.
I am in. If that does not exist, I'd be
surprised. I'm sure it does.
Finally, we got one last bit of film news to get through, and this is the most important one. This is one that like made me leap for joy when I heard that this was happening. Joss motherfucking Whedon. That's his full name.
His Christian name.
Is now attached to make a Batgirl movie for DC. And that is insane. Of course, Joss Whedon, creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and Firefly and Dollhouse. He directed The Avengers and Avengers Age of Ultron. He co-wrote Cabin in the Woods. I love Joss Whedon. And, you know, the DC universe has been such a dour and bleak place to be, man. It's been a rough go for the DC universe. But with the addition of Joss Whedon doing a Batgirl movie, I gotta wonder, like, is the tide maybe, like, turning on the Snyderverse? Are we escaping the pull of Zack Snyder and, like, embracing newer and different kinds of filmmakers? I mean, you've got, if you've got Joss Whedon making Batgirl, supposedly you got James Wan making Aquaman, Matt Reeves is attached to Batman, they got Chris McKay from the Lego Batman movie on the Nightwing movie. You know, there's
that's still like a crazy thing.
Weird thing, yeah. So I mean, there's a weird amount of movies that are shifting. There's a weird shift of the focus to tertiary Batman characters for these movies.
Yeah. Well, I think with the failure of Suicide Squad, they kind of, or maybe it's not even that. There is just a lack of creativity on the executives that are in charge of this movie universe, where they can't escape Batman. He's the only character in the DC universe that matters, and apparently we have to make all of his movies.
Yeah, but Joss Whedon making Batgirl is just incredibly, incredibly exciting, man. I picture Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but in a Batman costume.
That is pretty sweet. I do have a mixed feelings on this. It's interesting. I don't know. I think if of any of the people I trust to do this in the DC universe is Joss Whedon. And it's interesting that he's coming back to this larger comic book universe movie, even though, because if I remember correctly, after Age of Ultron, he was pretty beat up and like over it with these kind of large, big studio comic book tentpole movies.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Age of Ultron is, I think, has been unfairly maligned by a lot of fan, like people for some reason. Ultron is a movie that people take down a lot. Like
everyone hates that movie, but us.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Like, I think it's like top three Marvel movies. Like one of their best. That's so good. And a lot of that is Joss Whedon. That movie feels like a straight shot of like everything that makes Joss Whedon great.
Right.
And you know, all the themes and stuff that he's trying to analyze there. But that movie is a movie that Joss Whedon had a lot of creative issues with at Marvel. He was fighting them every step of the way. And he basically said, like, after the movie, like, you know, his contract with Marvel was up, he's done. That's why he didn't come back for Avengers 3. And he wants to, you know, kind of chill for a while, focus on smaller stuff. And he hasn't come out with anything since Age of Ultron ended, I don't think, other than those voting commercials that he did before the election. So it's surprising that he's going back to DC, but I think that could ultimately be encouraging, because why would he go back to this kind of big superhero stuff if he wasn't guaranteed, like, you know, complete creative control, unless they drove like a dump truck full of money to his house.
Which I'm sure they did also.
I'm sure that was also part of it. But like, I think DC may be listening to the fan response to these movies and basically how shitty they are. And, you know, are trying to get people involved who would raise the estimation of these movies by people, I'm hoping. So Joss Whedon is a huge step. Because, I mean, this is a pretty big jump from Marvel to DC. This has got to be like the biggest, in terms of rivalries, this is a pretty big one, you know? This is J.J. Abrams jumping from Star Trek to Star Wars all over again, you know?
Yeah, it's going to shake up stuff. But my hint of hesitation, I guess, would be, why not give the Batgirl movie to a female director? Now, like I said, I think Joss Whedon, of all the male directors, is the one that I trust the most to do justice to this character and this type of story, I assume. But it seems like it would have been a good opportunity for DC or Warner Brothers to give this movie to a female director. Not that this means anything that this is going to be a bad movie. It's just something I have been thinking about.
Yeah, no, I could see that. That's definitely true. But Joss Whedon, at the same time, is also one of his traits is writing very empowered female characters. He's a pretty staunch feminist himself. And so I don't think it's that big of a problem. And they also gave Wonder Woman to a female director. I want them to get to a point where, you know, they hire female directors for movies that aren't necessarily focused on female superheroes. That'd be kind of nice.
That would be sweet. Yeah,
but we'll get there one day. I mean, that did happen once. Lexi Alexander directed Punisher Warzone, but it hasn't happened in any of the Marvel the Marvel Studios, the DC movies yet. So
one day.
So anyway, I think this news is incredibly cool. I hope that this movie happens. DC has like 25 movies in the works right now.
Yeah, hopefully 5 of them actually get made.
Yeah, I mean, if it was me, if I was DC, like, this is the project I would like fast track. This is the one I want to see. Like, this is the one that I want to see.
And yeah,
this is the one that I think fans would want to see. Like, if I was a studio head, like Joss Whedon making a Batgirl movie, like that, this seems like a no brainer. You know?
Yeah, definitely. And the thing I also saw, I want people wondering about: will this be them? DC making the jump also to these kind of standalone, smaller scale superhero movies like Nightwing and Batgirl. Specifically, I mean, Nightwing especially is definitely like a tertiary or secondary character. Batgirl a little less so, but especially like we talked about before with Joss Whedon's frustrations of having to deal with this huge overarching universe with the Avengers things. I wonder if he will be making this in a more standalone fashion in the DC universe, which could be interesting or exciting. DC changing stuff up like we've talked about. We'll have to wait and find out.
Definitely. I'm hoping 2017 is the last we have to deal with the Snyderverse. You know, that's basically it. We got Justice League coming out this year, and then past that, maybe the tides of DC will be turning. We do have Wonder Woman to look forward to, and hopefully that's good.
Yes. But hopefully,
You know, did you see the trailer for Justice League by any chance that just came out recently?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it looks pretty much the same as.
Great.
Yeah, I mean, I feel they, you know, visually it looks basically the same, but there's like a little more emphasis in like playful banter. But it just.
It's gonna be so. I just had the worst.
Yeah, it just feels very. Vision. It feels very awkward because that's not something that like I, you know, I want Zack Snyder to be able to make the movie that he wants to make, you know?
Right.
And it's totally fine if that movie sucks. That's like you know, I don't want him like to be forced to do something based on what the studio wants him to do.
Right.
And I think that's kind of like the studio's trying to recognize, like, hey, you know, have Batman crack a joke here in this scene or whatever. And in the trailer, that's what it kind of looks like. It's like he's kind of being forced to like have like Batman crack a joke, or like somebody says, like, there's a part in the trailer where Ezra Miller as the Flash asks Batman, like, hey, what are your powers again? And Ben Affleck looks at him and is like, I'm rich. And like, that's kind of his.
Oh my God.
And it's like,
just the continuity or the character or relationship arc of Superman telling Batman that if I wanted it, you'd be dead already, to them making jokes together feels real strange.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm hoping Justice League is good, but you know what? Like, Man of Steel was like, fool me once. Batman for Superman's like, fool me twice.
Yeah.
So I don't know about a third time around, but anyway, that's a little off topic. The point is, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Is what we're saying. Joss Whedon, you know, that's the dream. Anyway, so I think we should get out of film news, Mike. That about wraps that up. Let's get into our discussions.
These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There's so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today I have two movies. I jumped in my time machine and went back to 1985, Mike.
It was a good year.
And it was a good year, I've heard. my first movie is Lady Hawk. This movie came out, like I said, 1985, directed by Richard Donner. Stars Rutger Hauer, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Matthew Broderick. And Lady Hawk is this silly 80s fantasy cheesy love story. It's about Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer. Are characters that were in love, forbidden love, and they got cursed. So during the day, Michelle Pfeiffer is a hawk, and during the night, Rutger Hauer is a wolf, and they never the twain shall meet. They're never able to be together as lovers and stuff. And it's just silly, campy, cheesy, love conquers evil, funny, you know, that kind of fantasy story.
Yeah.
But it's actually really enjoyable. Matthew Broderick is hilarious. He plays this little, like, street urchin kid that's always talking to God and thinks everything is, like, he narrates his whole story, to, like, as if he's telling God his story, and it's silly.
Yeah.
Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer are really convincing in their love, and it's cool to see, you know, Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer in their young prime. But it is the most 80s thing of all time. And you know how I know that, Mike?
How do you know that, Mike?
The soundtrack and score was written by and performed by the Alan Parsons Project.
That's pretty dope. That's pretty
cool. Yeah. That's what I thought. I was like, hell yeah, this is going to be like silly, weird prog 80s music. And it's not that great, though. Wow. But it's still... It adds to the charm.
I hope one day we look back at like the current age of music and see like contemporary musicians scoring movies and being like, wow, that's super weird. That's so 2010s. Right? Yeah. Daft Punk doing Tron Legacy. What?
What? this movie's great, but the soundtrack really dates it. which is how I feel, because they're kind of like, because it's the Alan Parsons Project, they're trying to like recreate medieval music, like, you know, like with synthesizers and weird shit going on. But it's funny, it's silly.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you want a silly romp, 80s like fantasy cheesy love story, watch Lady Hawk, and then also watch my second movie.
Yeah, I've never seen either of these movies you've talked about, but I did want to mention and in accordance to Lady Hawk, Rutger Hauer stars in that movie, and I just ended up rewatching Blade Runner recently, and man, I feel like I didn't appreciate the first time I saw it how fucking good Rutger Hauer is.
Yeah, Rutger Hauer is always someone that I've been aware of as an actor, and like I have enjoyed the movies I've seen him in, but I haven't seen a whole lot of his movies. I think Hobo with a Shotgun.
It's a great movie.
It's a great, phenomenal movie. And Rutger Hauer's amazing in it. Yes. So it's cool to see him in Lady Hawk in his young playing, you know, his prime playing a knight kind of thing.
Nice.
Instead of a grizzled old hobo. But my second movie, also came out in 1985, is called Legend.
Okay, the Ridley Scott movie, right?
Yes, directed by Ridley Scott, stars Tom Cruise, Mia Sara, and Tim Curry. Yes, Tim Curry plays the Lord of Darkness in this movie, or as he's credited, Darkness.
And Mia Sara is Ferris Bueller's girlfriend and from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, right?
Yes, this actually came out the year before Ferris Bueller, so right. Pre-Ferris Bueller fame, I guess. I don't know.
Cool.
And it's the same thing. This is a campy weirdness. There's a lot of amazing practical effects. Tim Curry, as the Lord of Darkness, is somehow made to look 10 feet tall, and he's full in full red devil makeup with giant horns.
Oh, my God.
He's doing a...
How about I see this movie?
Yeah, that's... I had heard of Legend, and one of my friends told me Tim Curry plays the devil in it. And I was like, well, I guess I got to go watch that now. And he does an amazing performance.
I'm sure.
And it's a literal fairy tale. Tom Cruise and Mia Sara plays a princess who falls in love with Tom Cruise's character, who's a kind of like wildling in the woods type thing.
Yeah.
And they disturb the unicorns in the woods, and that allows darkness to rise. And, you know, it's just forbidden love, fairy tales, good versus evil. They plunge the forest into winter, and Tom Cruise has to join up with a bunch of dwarves and elves to stop darkness. And it's right. Silly stuff, which is kind of funny, like, because most of my experience with Ridley Scott is like hard sci-fi horror. to see him do this kind of campy 80s fairy tale stuff was a lot of fun.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's definitely it's a hard recommend for me.
Cool.
Even if and I think it's a it would be fun to watch with a lot of friends and kind of like riff it while watching it type movie.
Yeah.
But it's still good if you want to just enjoy it for its own.
Cool. Yes, that's Legend, Ridley Scott, and yes. Lady Hawk. Yeah,
correct.
Both of those sound pretty good. I've never seen either one, and I should probably get on that.
Yeah, I do want to give a warning to our listeners to buckle up, because I have a list of 80s cult fantasy movies that I will be plowing through for the foreseeable future. So D&D or D&D, I don't know why I said D&D. That works,
it's always,
though.
It's always on your mind.
It is always on my mind. And it's tangential to what these movies are.
Yeah.
But 80s cult palooza starts now,
starts
I guess.
Starts now.
Yeah. Still workshopping that title.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. And then I have a few things to discuss. More contemporary films. Saw these all in the theater. The first is the movie that we were probably going to review this week if Mike had seen it, but he did not, so I'll talk about it now. Beauty and the Beast, which is the new film directed by Bill Condon, and it's the latest in the live-action Disney remake craze. We've talked about Disney remakes a lot on this show, Mike.
We have.
I feel like we talk about them probably way too much. But, you know, for my money, they're a pretty mixed bag. You know, I did like The Jungle Book. I really like Pete's Dragon. Hated Alice in Wonderland with a passion, sir. And Beauty and the Beast kind of falls somewhere in the middle for me. You know, it's I think it's a very well cast movie. Like, the cast in this movie is actually pretty outstanding. Emma Watson's a good Belle. Dan Stevens, who is on The Guest, he's also on Legion on FX. He plays the Beast. And by the way, Legion, fucking incredible, man. The season just
still good.
The season just ended, and I haven't watched the finale yet, but I just watched the second to last episode, and like, holy shit, dude.
All right.
Dude, you gotta watch it. It's so good. But yeah, Dan Stevens plays the Beast, and Luke Evans plays Gaston and crushes it. Luke Evans was in the Hobbit movies. He's also the bad guy in Fast and Furious 6. He plays Gaston in this movie, and he's incredible. He's the best part about this movie, no question. And, like, Ewan McGregor plays Lumiere. Ian McKellen plays Cogsworth. Emma Thompson plays Mrs. Potts. It's, like, a pretty outstanding cast all around. But while it's a very well-cast movie, and the production design is really good, it all just feels so soulless, you know? It just feels... In a way that the other Disney remakes don't really to me. I feel like Pete's Dragon had a lot of heart to it, you know? Pete's Dragon, mm-hmm. I think, is the best out of all these Disney remakes by far. And even like Alice in Wonderland is terrible, but you know, I feel like it feels like Tim Burton was just given a canvas to work with, and then he did his thing, you know?
Right.
And this movie, it just feels like a product that's being pushed on you without any, like, original thought put into it. It's mostly just a recreation of the animated film, but it's in live action. And the changes that it makes, because it does make some changes, tend to make the story worse. Like, it's, you know, there's a couple of original songs in there, and they're fine. They're okay. Like, there's one song that's actually pretty good. But, you know, it's also, like, you know, the animated movie has, like, what, 6 or 7 songs? Like, it's an animated Disney movie. So they have songs, right, and they're usually memorable songs, but there's not that many of them. So this movie has to pad it out a little bit because it's, like, a 2-hour live-action movie as opposed to, like, an 80-minute animated movie, which is another part of its problem. It does the exact same story, but it's just longer.
just what you always wanted a remake to do.
Yeah. But, you know, part of it is that, you know, they add these new original songs, but it's, like, they have there's a musical play on Broadway. They could just take songs from that, but they don't. The songs in the Broadway musical are good. Like, there's good songs in there. They don't even take Human Again, which is one of the which was a deleted song from the animated movie that ended up in the Broadway play. You know, it's a very good song, and it's not in this Disney remake. And it's like, why? Like, it's like, why not use this when you do use this other song that basically does the same thing as Human Again? Like I said, it serves the same function in terms of where the story is and where the characters are, but it's just worse. Like, it's
if they don't write their own music, Mike, how are they going to get an Oscar for best original score or song?
Honestly, that's why they did it. Like, that's the only reason to add original songs to this is because they want Oscar consideration for best original song. And it will probably get a nomination because this movie made like $30 billion in its opening weekend.
Minimum $30
billion. by the time it's all over, it just kind of feels like, what was the point of that? You know, what did I get out of this experience that I couldn't have gotten out of the animated movie? And I gotta say, like, it's not much. Like I said, Luke Evans plays Gaston. He's great. He's good. Josh Gad is LeFou, and that's a good casting choice. But at the same time, like, I find Josh Gad kind of annoying. So it's, you know, whatever. And like, the songs are well covered. It feels like they're well covered, but I think a lot of them are very awkwardly staged, especially the first one, the song Belle, which I think is the best song in the whole movie, in the animated movie. Is, you know, it just feels very, like, awkwardly put together. Like, it feels like it's musical theater blocking, but it doesn't have any kind of, like, cinematic quality to it. It just feels like it's just very weirdly staged and put together. And I think a lot of the songs, like, they all feel like cover versions of the original movie songs, and they all feel like they're worse because of it. And I don't know. I just wasn't crazy. Also, the CGI in this movie for the you know, the household objects like Lumiere and Cogsworth, right, I think looks like garbage. Like, it looks really bad. Like, it looks really bad. And, like, I think the CGI is, like, fine, and it's technically impressive. Like, it makes these characters look realistic, but these characters shouldn't look realistic. You know, I think you lose a lot of the expression in that way. Like you don't get a lot of the emotion in the faces of Lumiere or Cogsworth or anything because they actually look like candles and clocks and not, you know, like cartoon, like anthropomorphic cartoon
right
faces. And so and the thing is, like, I found myself, like, I thought it was fine. Like, I enjoyed a lot of it, and I had, like, a decent amount of fun, but I just feel like there's not that much here to latch onto. Like, I feel like the experience of watching it was over for me as soon as it was over. Like, I never ruminated on it afterwards. Like, all I really thought about was, like, man, like, it really made me want to go back and watch the animated movie. Like, it's and, you know, with the Jungle Book, like, that movie arguably, like, improved on the animated movie in a lot of aspects. And, like, Pete's Dragon did the same. And so, I don't know. Beating the Beast, man. It's,
yeah, but don't worry. We're going to get a bunch more because they make a bajillion dollars.
Yeah. I mean, who knows, like, what the other ones are going to look like. At least, like, Jon Favreau is making The Lion King, and, like, he made the Jungle Book. So maybe that'll be something. But I feel like now they're entering the phase where they're making, like, they're doing Beating the Beast, and they're doing The Lion King, and they're doing Aladdin. And it feels like they're... like, the first few Disney remakes that they've done have been much older movies that people may not have as much of an emotional attachment to, and so they maybe feel more freedom to change things as they see fit. And Beauty and the Beast, what came out in 91, like, it's not that long ago, pretty much everybody in the world, like, has seen Beauty and the Beast, which is why this movie made, like, $80 bajillion. The number keeps going up.
It's gonna be, yeah. Can you imagine the uproar that will happen if they are not quote unquote faithful to The Lion King? Like, what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's bizarre.
What if they just do? What if he just does like full on Hamlet, like with the Shakespearean dialogue? But
I would be all about that. But actually, speaking of that, that was one of the worst changes in this movie in the Beauty and the Beast remake.
I'm so interested to see where you go with this.
Well, okay. So, when was the last time you saw Beauty and the Beast? Do you remember anything about it?
I haven't seen it in a long time.
All right. So in the original movie, like, you know, Belle and the Beast are kind of at odds at first, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you could say.
They're not the biggest fans of each other. But one of the things about the original movie is, you know, the Beast gives Belle his library in the castle, right? Like, that's
right.
One of the big things. And, like, Belle's a huge bookworm. She's, like, loves to read and stuff like that. And part of the arc, part of the Beast's arc in that movie is that he does not know how to read at the beginning of the movie. He's like a simpleton, and he can't read. And so throughout that movie, Belle like teaches him how to read, and it's
right.
Like, it's part of his arc. Like, he's growing and he's changing for her. Like, he's falling in love with her. And that's part of what makes that relationship more interesting. In this movie, the Beast does know how to read, and he talks down to Belle for liking certain books that that he doesn't like.
And oh, so my God, he's a gamergator? No.
He's like a douchey hipster. He's the Iron Fist of Disney Beasts. It's really bad.
It's so weird.
And they end up bonding over like their shared love of reading instead of like her teaching him how to read. But like when it first happens, like he gives her the library and stuff, and she's like tending over to him after he saves her. And she's like quoting a Shakespeare thing as she's doing it. And he like recognizes the line and he's like, oh yeah. And they start talking about Shakespeare and she's like, and he was like, oh, what's your favorite? And she's like, oh, Romeo and Juliet. And he's like, piffle, like Romeo and Juliet. Like, he scoffs at her and it's like, Jesus, man.
I feel like that was their attempt at a clever, like, hey, forbidden lover story. But like, that comes off.
Well, yeah, no, it definitely was. But,
it was
rough. But again, I feel like the movie's almost worth seeing just for Luke Evans as Gaston. He's great. He's so good. Wow. He's so good in that role. But yeah, Beauty and the Beast, I think, like, again, it's not the worst thing in the world. Like, it's nice to look at, and like it's a really good cast, and like, it's, you know, it's fun to see some of these songs performed in live action. But at the same time, it's just there. It just exists. That's all it does. It just happens. I sat down in the theater, I saw some images, and then I walked out, you know?
There you go. That's what everyone's looking for in a movie.
But anyway, that's Beauty and the Beast. It's right now upwards of $1 trillion in the box office.
It has made one Google money.
One Google money. It has made the equivalent of the U.S. national debt in the span of this conversation.
Our budget crisis is solved.
Maybe that's how we'll do it. Disney will just have to remake more of these movies and just funnel it to the U.S. government, and that'll be it. Like, they'll just make one on spec or something.
There we go. Beautiful.
Not the worst idea in the world. U.S. government, call us. We cannot be worse than the guy you got now. anyway, believe it or not, Mike, I do have other movies to talk about in my discussions.
Oh, what? Okay, hold on.
Which we should probably get to. And the next one I wanted to talk about is this movie called Life. I hear it comes at you fast.
You son of a bitch.
This is the new movie directed by Daniel Espinosa, who was the director of the movie Safe House with Denzel Washington a few years ago. And you know what? Speaking of pointless remakes that do nothing but recreate scenes from the original movie, I also saw Life this weekend, which desperately, desperately wishes it was Alien.
Wow.
Like, it is just straight up a riff of Alien. And this movie is okay. I think it's a little bit better than Beauty and the Beast. You know, there are some decent horror sequences throughout this movie, especially in the first half. But we're really just not given that much to work with when it comes to caring about these characters. And it doesn't help that these supposedly very smart scientists in this movie are doing incredibly dumb things throughout this movie. It's the kind of movie where a lot of the dialogue is, screw this, I'm going in.
Oh, my God.
You know? And, you know, there are some sequences towards the end of this movie that are laughably bad. And you know, like, there's one in particular that is like, so bad, I couldn't believe my entire theater wasn't laughing at it. Because I was, and I felt bad for laughing at it. But I was also able to tell where the movie was going, like, towards the end. I think before the movie even realized it was going there. You know?
God.
But still, there is some solid horror stuff here. And the monster is pretty cool. And it's like the monster is presented as a very smart creature. And, you know, it, especially towards the beginning, there's the monster does some really like cool and interesting things. And then towards the end, it kind of just becomes a generic monster. But it's, you know, solid fun. It's not great. It's no Alien. But it scratches the B-movie itch and will tide me over until Alien Covenant comes out, at least. Because that's the thing. It also feels like life is like... Like, what's the point of this movie when we have a new Alien movie coming out in 2 months, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But you know what they say about life? It finds a way.
God. All right. That one was pretty good. I'll give you that one.
All right. And I have one last movie to talk about. And this is a movie called Raw. Mike, have you heard anything about this movie?
No. I don't think I even know what this is.
Yeah. This is a new movie directed by Julia Ducournau. And I knew very little about this movie going into it. And I had not seen a single trailer or anything like that. I knew kind of the basic premise. It was a cool experience, and I would recommend that experience if you can. But I am going to say what the premise of the movie is, and I might go into a little more detail than I knew about before.
Go in blind to this movie. I'm going to spoil it.
I'm not going to spoil it, but I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you what the movie is basically about.
So you're advocating for joining me in the Unsullied? Is what you're saying?
I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that. I mean, I feel like you're not a true Unsullied. You know,
that's
not,
true. Yeah,
you know, because you do watch trailers and. But you don't, like, seek them out, which is basically where I am. Like, I don't seek out trailers really anymore, unless I know I'm going to see them anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But so with Raw, like, I hadn't seeked out any trailers. And so Raw is a foreign film. It's a French horror movie / coming-of-age story that centers on a young girl entering veterinary school who discovers that she has a taste for human flesh. And her gradual discovery of these cannibalistic urges kind of parallels her sexual journey and dealing with these urges. And so this movie is insane.
That's a hot take. That's wow.
And I really, really dug it. This is a really fun movie. There's so much like the imagery of teens partying in this movie evokes something like Spring Breakers, and like the gradual descent into goriness is totally fucked up and really entertaining. And the sound design is like all encompassing, and the score is so good, like it's just so intense and like I was about to say it's Raw, but that's the name of the movie and I didn't want to say that. And the soundtrack is a lot of fun. It's just a really intense movie-going experience. There's a ton of dark humor here, and I really enjoyed it. So if you can see Raw, I saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse recently, and it is really great. It's playing in very limited release right now, but it's quite good. I heard about – I think it was a different Alamo Drafthouse. I think it was the one in L.A. They actually handed out barf bags to the audience for this movie. Which
– That's amazing.
I don't even think it's that gory. Like I feel like that's a little that's a little much.
Yeah, that's a publicity stunt.
Because it is like there are some definitely gross scenes in this movie and like some really uncomfortable stuff that's happening. But at the same time, I feel like there's not that much of it. Like the stuff that's in there is pretty gross. But it's also like a very small portion of what the movie actually is. And so, again, I think Raw is really interesting. I will say the Alamo Drafthouse, normally I will get some food while I'm there. Did not do that for this movie.
Probably a good call.
Yeah. Just didn't feel appropriate at the time. Some guy next to me did, though, and he seemed to be really enjoying it. But anyway, so that's Raw. Really enjoyed it. I highly recommend going to see this French horror movie about a young teen cannibal instead of the movie instead of the family Disney movie. And those are my discussions for the day, Mike. So should we move on to our Netflix reviews? Or not Netflix reviews. That's a different podcast. But,
technically not wrong. Yeah. Technically not wrong.
You're right. No, normally for our other podcast, The Complete Works, we go into Netflix reviews for the movie that we're talking about. And normally for this podcast, we do not. But we are reviewing a movie that came out on Netflix. So technically, yes, Mike, this is a Netflix review. And let's do that right now.
We're gonna get into our Netflix reviews.
We're getting into our Netflix reviews of The Discovery starting right now.
Dr. Harper, why did it take you 6 months to address us? Where have you been?
It seems to me that I invite you here to my home.
We only received that invitation after the suicide toll had rapidly reached 1 million. you think your discovery was just too dangerous to share with the world?
Isla! Isla!
That was from the trailer for The Discovery, directed by Charlie McDowell. This movie stars Jason Segel, Rooney Mara, Robert Redford, Jesse Plemons, and Riley Keough, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for this movie is not really a plot synopsis. It's a sentence fragment is what this is.
Interesting.
It's not even a full sentence. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, "A love story set 1 year after the existence of the afterlife is scientifically verified." That's all it says.
I mean, yeah, like that, I guess that's a true statement.
It is a true statement, but it's not even a full statement. It's if they said it is a love story, I would be like, okay, all right.
All right. Yeah.
It just says a love story set 1 year after the existence of the afterlife is scientifically verified. Okay. IMDb, I need a little more to go on. I will set the scene a little more clearly in just a minute. But so I was a huge fan of Charlie McDowell's first film, which was The One I Love, which ended up being my favorite movie of 2014. I'm pretty sure I made you watch that movie too, right?
Yeah, I think, did we do an episode on that? Or did we talk about it as a discussion? I don't remember, but...
That was before we had a podcast, I think.
Maybe. I don't remember. But definitely, we have talked about it, you and I.
Yeah.
I just assume it's on podcasts now.
I mean, most of the time it is. If we did talk about that, that would have been
a discussion.
One of our very first podcasts. Yeah, we definitely didn't review it, but we would have discussed it. I guess I'd have to go back and check it out, and maybe I will. I sometimes listen to our podcasts, like just like as I'm trying to go to sleep, because I like the sound of my own, I like the sound of my own voice.
I would have pretend that was a compliment to me, also.
I mean, it's not a compliment towards you.
That's true, technically true.
Anyway, yeah, so The One I Love is a movie that I love, and it's the one... off to a great start. The One I Love is a very low-key movie with only a couple of actors, Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass, that deals with this insane sci-fi premise that kind of forces the viewer to answer questions about their own existence that they may not have considered before. And in that regard, The Discovery is kind of similar, although it expands that scope significantly, asking bigger questions, getting big-name actors. It even has more than one set.
Insane. It's more than just one lake house or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Guest house.
Exactly. This movie premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and it was one of the few movies that was picked up by Netflix. Netflix released it on their streaming service on March 31st, so it is now available for your viewing pleasure at this very moment. So to set the scene a little more clearly than IMDb does, as the movie begins, the world has been completely changed after Robert Redford's character scientifically proves, using science, that there is an afterlife after you die. They don't know what is there or how you get there, but they conclusively, scientifically prove, using science, that it exists.
Right.
And this results in the suicide rate in the world just spiking, like skyrocketing. People are killing themselves left and right just to get to the afterlife. And then we pick up about 2 years later with Robert Redford trying to figure out exactly what the afterlife is and how to see what the afterlife is. And I think that is a great premise for a movie. Like I'm 100% on board with that idea. And I think it starts off really, really strongly with that scene between Robert Redford and Mary Steenburgen interviewing him. And there is a lot of good stuff here. I don't think it comes together quite as well as The One I Love. It feels like, you know, McDowell is swinging for the fences with a lot of these questions and never gets to a totally satisfying conclusion. I will say I liked the movie. I think it's really interesting and does a lot of really interesting things. Mike, what was your kind of overall takeaway on The Discovery?
Yeah, I do agree with you that I don't know if it completely satisfies the question, but I don't think it can, right? It's asking about the afterlife and mortality and death and the toll that has on people in society. So, like, the two-hour movie is never going to – or an hour-and-a-half movie or whatever it is.
Right.
It's probably not going to answer that question. But I did find myself really hooked and pulled into this movie. And the mystery that ends up, you know, the second half of the movie or so is kind of like a whodunit. I mean, not really whodunit, but there are chasing answers and I'm just trying to solve this mystery, which was very engaging for me. That cold open, I think, is it before the credits even roll in the title, the interview that happens?
I believe so, yeah. I think the credits are rolling during that
scene.
During that, but yeah. I think the title comes up right after that scene, yeah.
Yeah, was one hell of a fucking way to start the movie.
Yeah, I think that's the best scene in the movie, actually. Like, it's really strong. But yeah, and I will say, this is an incredibly bleak movie.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm not sure I was totally prepared for that. There are a lot of moments of dry humor here. Like, there is definitely, like, humor kind of peppered throughout. But for the most part, it's pretty bleak. And
yeah, I think Jason Segel can't help but be funny. Even thing, like even when he's talking about death and afterlife,
and, yeah, I don't necessarily know about that, but yeah. But I think I do think its bleakness kind of makes it difficult to engage from that standpoint. Like it's tough to follow this, you know, bleak world. It's, you know, it's a Snyderverse.
This is the Snyderverse.
This is the Snyderverse of indie movies.
But it is an interesting, I can't think of the word, rumination, thoughts, whatever, on what would happen to our world if, using science, scientifically proven, there was an afterlife.
Yes.
And I think it comes to pretty... The conclusion the movie draws, I think it lines up with the one that I would also draw, that people would just off themselves. Like, that we know there's an afterlife, we're going. That is something really crazy to think about, right? What that would do to our world if using science there was a scientifically proven afterlife, and
right.
What that would be, why I think this is what would happen in some weird way. I don't know.
Yeah.
It definitely leads to lots of dark, bleak contemplations after this movie ended.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think I kind of would have liked to see the science behind it, like how he actually figured out.
Yeah.
Like, even if they just, like, showed an equation on a chalkboard, I'd be like, oh, okay, that's...
I think they mentioned it in that opening interview, but maybe not.
I mean, the way they describe it is he was able to conclusively prove that something leaves the body as that person dies. But they don't tell you how he conclusively proved it. And
yes.
Like, throughout the movie, it's like, you know, somebody's, like, in this first scene between Jason Segel and Rooney Mara, they're talking about it. And Rudy Mayer's like, oh, you don't believe? And it's like, oh, no, I mean, I believe, like, that it happens, sure. And it's like, yeah, well, I mean, the proof is overwhelming. And he's like, well, the proof is definitive. It's not overwhelming and that kind of thing. And they're talking about the proof, but they never tell you what the proof is.
Right. So that's, like, true.
And so it's like, oh, I feel like it's, like, just it's holding back a little bit. And I feel like that's information that I was really interested in finding out, like, How do they know there's an afterlife? Like, that seems like a key piece of information that's missing from this movie. I get that it's not the point of the movie. Like, that's not what the movie is trying to say. But at the same time, I feel like it is something that is natural for me to want to know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, I mean, I did like this movie quite a bit. But I think a lot of the problems that I do have from this movie actually kind of stem from Jason Segel, who I feel he plays the main character. And, you know, he's an actor that I think is great. And can do drama really well. The End of the Tour is an incredible movie. He's great in the movie as a David Foster Wallace. But it felt like his only direction for this movie was, quote unquote, act sad. Like, that was like, just be sad. Just be sad in the scene. And
then make a sarcastic comment. You're not wrong. That's definitely true.
Yeah. And that's kind of all he does. But I've read that apparently Nicholas Hoult was originally cast in that role. And I can't say that he would have been better, but I think he might have been able to pull off something a little more interesting. He's a more, like, esoteric actor, I would say. Like,
yeah.
You know, he can pull off some weird stuff when he wants to. Look at, like, Mad Max Fury Road. And so,
right.
You know, I'm not saying he would have been Nux in this movie, but, like, he... that might have been a little out of place. But I think he might have been able to pull something off that was a little more interesting than what Jason Segel does. That said, Robert Redford and Rooney Mara are... great, as always. Like, I think, like, Robert Redford, like, it's insane to me that it was a few years ago when I was like, man, it's insane that Robert Redford's starring in a Marvel movie, and now I'm like, right. Man, it's insane that Robert Redford is starring in a movie that's premiering on Netflix. Like,
yeah, in a hard science fiction movie on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think for the most part, the performances are really great. Even, oh man, the guy whose name I can't remember, the other brother, just said it before.
Jesse Plemons?
Yes, he is great as this weird, like, kind of stoner, dumb kid type character.
Yeah, he has some funny moments in the movie, actually. I don't know if you, I mean, I won't say, I guess I should save it for spoilers, but it's not really anything. There's a post-credit scene in this movie. I don't know if you saw it.
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Okay,
huh.
I'll save it for spoilers. It's nothing. It's like a quick, like,
oh, okay.
it's like a very quick thing. But Jesse Plemons has some funny moments, like when he's, like, at the church and he's, like, playing the guitar, like, and he's, like, just taking forever to get off the stage. And
yeah, and then he picks up the melodica and starts playing weird stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the simplest way to put this is that it feels like an extended Black Mirror episode, which is definitely how I thought for a lot of this movie.
Yeah, I could see that. That is actually a pretty accurate summation of this movie. And the ending of this movie, which we'll talk about much more in spoilers, it does a lot of things.
Shit escalates real quick.
Yeah, it pretty much throws everything at you and hopes you'll keep up. And I wasn't entirely sure it worked as I was watching it. And then, like, once the credits hit, like, it all just kind of clicks into place. And I was like, all right. Okay. Yeah, I can.
Sure.
I felt like I was on board. And yeah, it's like it was kind of. I was about to say it's overwhelming, but Jason Segel would say it's definitive.
Or it should be definitive.
Yeah. Actually, that's actually a foreshadowing for the ending. That whole conversation, like that, this is overwhelming or it's definitive. Like it's a.
Yeah. We'll get into that in spoilers.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I'm not as high on this one as I was as the one I love. Like the one I love, which seriously, everybody should go watch. I'm glad that I'm glad this movie exists. You know, like it is ambitious, and I'm super glad that Netflix is getting this kind of like weird and different movie out there. You know, it's very bleak. I feel like it'd be very difficult for a movie like this to get distribution. And I think it probably would have, you know, because it has like a lot of big names in it, you know, Jason Segel, Rooney Mara, and Robert Redford. But I think more people are going to see it this way through Netflix than would have otherwise if it did like the traditional like go into limited release theaters and nobody will see it, and then go into video on demand and nobody will hear of it and it'll just kind of disappear.
Right.
You know, the one I love got a huge amount of critical response when that movie came out. But it was also like a very small indie movie, and I was only able to see it when it hit Netflix. Like that was when,
right?
And so it's sort of fitting that this movie just went straight to Netflix. And again, we have talked about this so much that Netflix is just destroying it when it's coming to the original content game these days. And they have so much original TV shows in the works, and this year it seems like they're really trying to get into the original movies game.
Yeah, I mean, I think this the Discovery mirrors the movie we both talked about, or I talked about, I don't remember.
We both watched that. You talked about it a while ago, but we definitely both watched it.
Yeah, I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Yeah,
which was I believe picked up at Sundance also.
It
by
was.
Netflix.
That was. I mean, that was the Grand Jury Prize winner at Sundance. That was the big winner at Sundance, and it got picked up by Netflix. This is another one. I believe there was at least one other movie that played at Sundance that's premiering on Netflix, but I'm blanking on what it was. But they also came out with this movie called Imperial Dreams with John Boyega. And that's a movie that had been sitting on the shelf for a while that Netflix picked up. And there's more stuff coming this year. I mean, you have Adam Wingard's Death Note is happening,
right.
Which I'm pretty stoked for that. And there's Bong Joon-ho's Okja, which I'm pretty stoked for that too. And there's David Wayne has a new movie coming out based on the National Lampoon. Like it's a National Lampoon biopic called A Stupid and Futile Gesture, I think is what it's called. And there's so much stuff happening on Netflix, and that's not to say like all their TV shows, which like, you know, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Master of None and BoJack Horseman, they're all going to be coming back this year, and Sense8's coming back this year, and so much good stuff. And also they have a bunch of comedy specials coming back this year from like huge comedians. Like in the past few weeks, there's been Mike Birbiglia, Amy Schumer, Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K. has one coming out in this week. And like Jerry Seinfeld has one coming out, and Chris Rock has one coming out. This is a shitload of stuff happening on Netflix right now.
Big stuff. Netflix, up and coming. Keep an eye out.
Yeah. yeah, these guys are really going places.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, I'm really glad that Netflix exists so that the Discovery has a way to get out there. My worry is that it gets buried under all this content. You know?
Yeah.
And that's my worry for a lot of the stuff on Netflix, which, you know, there's so many things on Netflix that I would not know were on Netflix if I didn't, like, search for them specifically. I actually just recently got an app called Just Watch, and this app is amazing. I highly recommend everybody download this app. They're not paying me to say that. That is the thing. But Just Watch is a great app because if you type in a movie or a TV show, it tells you everywhere that thing is streaming.
Wow, that's really fucking cool.
Yeah, and so I wanted to watch. I've been going through this thing on Netflix through my Netflix DVD plan. There's a recurring segment on the AV Club called A History of Violence, where they go through the history of action movies. And I've been going through some of the ones that I haven't seen. And I wanted to speed up the process a little bit because then my DVD plan, you know, I can get maybe like a DVD a week or something, depending on when I watch them. And so I ended up getting Just Watch. And it turned out one of the movies that I was about to get on the DVD plan was on Netflix. And I was
look at that.
And I was like, oh, I would never have. I spend a lot of time just scrolling through Netflix. And I would never have known that it was there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we are all slaves to the Netflix algorithm.
Exactly. And that's a bummer. That's a bummer for sure. But I hope the Discovery is able to get on enough people's radar, which is why I think it's good that we're talking about it here. You know, even if it's a movie that I'm not over the moon about and nearly as much as The One I Love, which, again, The One I Love, man, so good. I don't know if that's still on Netflix, but if it is, people should watch it. Like,
yeah,
100%. Like, that's a movie that I wanted to rewatch that after I saw The Discovery. But The Discovery has a lot of the same ideas of The One I Love. Like, I feel like it just takes a lot of the stuff that was in that movie, but kind of expands them to a broader scope. And I don't think it's completely successful, but I think it is really, really interesting, and it is a good movie. So I really enjoyed it. Mike, do you have any other thoughts about The Discovery? Or about Netflix, or should we get into spoilers for Discovery?
I think we should get into spoilers because the escalation of the third act is a lot, and I think there's a lot to unpack in there.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So let's get into spoilers.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for The Discovery starting right now.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! You're spoiling everything.
All right. So spoilers for The Discovery starting right now. So yes, there is a post-credit scene in this movie. It's very, very quick. It's like 5 seconds. It's Jesse Plemons messing with his guitar again in the church.
All right. That's fair.
Which, yeah, is fine. But yeah, basically, like, the actual ending of this movie is a little more insane than that. So this entire movie, Robert Redford has been trying to access this machine. Like, he's been creating this machine that he thinks will allow them to see what the afterlife is like if somebody, like, goes into it and, like, maybe dies for like a second and comes back. And that's kind of what he's been doing, is like killing himself very briefly and like resuscitating him back to life before he can actually die. So he can see what's going on. Like he can record what's going on. And they test it out on a cadaver at a certain point in the movie. And that's kind of what the second half of this movie is like them explore, like Jason Segel and Rooney Mara kind of exploring what they recorded on this guy's head, because they don't think it is the afterlife. I think it's something that happened in the real world. It's some kind of memory. I did kind of figure out what was happening, like, before the characters did.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You know, I'm a smart viewer, so it's fine.
Yeah, you were engaged.
Yeah. So basically what the machine ends up doing is it shows you your memories, but it shows you reworked versions of your memories. Like, it kind of allows you to change the things that you regret the most in your life. But, I mean, not in real life, like, not in your actual life, but inside this machine. But it also kind of raises questions about, well, what is existence and what is your actual life, you know, that kind of thing. And so it is revealed at the end of this movie that the entire movie has been Jason Segel inside Robert Redford's memory machine replaying the same memories of meeting Rooney Mara over and over again until he gets them right. Right? Am I reading this right?
I think I interpreted it a different way.
Really?
The way I took it was that the quote-unquote afterlife is sliding to a different timeline where you get to redo your greatest regret. So that even though that they actually are dying, the machine allows them to record it and view it, though. So the way I interpreted it was that they see that cadaver's greatest regret was not visiting his father in the hospital. We see while Robert Redford is dead, he doesn't stop he stops his wife.
Right.
And then in this version of the afterlife, we are shown that Jason Segel has been doing this forever. So the machine allows us to view the fact that he's already dead, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay. So what I'm saying is, I feel like when I watched the end of this movie, I feel like it was kind of I feel like it's shown that Jason Segel's been replaying the same moment over and over again, almost like this like weird kind of Groundhog Day-esque thing, where he's just replaying him meeting Rooney Mara for the first time until he gets it right, because what he discovered is that, you know, in his quote-unquote real life, like his actual physical life, Rooney Mara, after their first meeting, went to a beach and killed herself.
Right.
That was what happened. And so that's not what happens throughout the course of the movie. In the course of the movie, you see that she's at the beach and is about to kill herself, but Jason Segel's there to save her, and they bond, and they get close to each other. And then towards the end of the movie, Lacey, who Robert Redford has like excommunicated from the group, comes back and shoots Rooney Mara, and Rooney Mara dies right there. And so Jason Segel goes back to the machine and relives the memories again. But I feel like how I interpreted it is that the entire movie was Jason Segel going through those things, because Rooney Mara did kill herself in real life. That's what, like, I mean, the character Rooney Mara plays killed herself. Killed herself in this movie. And so Jason Segel has been going back to the machine over and over and over again, like in the machine.
Interesting. Okay. That's, yeah, I still have a different thing, a different interpretation, but yours works also, which is I think a beauty of this movie.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But then he, at the end of the, like, you know, there's this scene where she kind of explains to him what's happening and, like, explains that, like, he's not going to remember this moment and, like, he's going to, leave. And then you kind of hear, like, voices outside. You hear Jesse Plemons and Robert Redford going, like, he's dying, he's going. And I feel like at that point, Jason Segel actually physically dies in real life, and then he goes to the afterlife. And that last scene is the afterlife, isn't it? Like, that's the actual afterlife where he finds the kid. And it turns out to be Rooney Mara's kid, who she had talked about losing many years earlier. Like, she had talked about.
Right.
And so he finds the kid in the ocean, and then Rooney Mara comes out, and he looks at her, and he thinks she looks familiar. And then the movie ends.
Right.
And so to me, that was like what the afterlife was. And he saw Rooney Mara and the kid there, both of whom would have been dead at this point. So it would make sense that they were in the afterlife.
Yeah. That definitely makes sense. I think that last scene on the beach is definitely a afterlife, but the way I interpret it, let me see if I could explain it, is that, for the whole movie, Jason Segel has already been dead. And through the machine, we're able to learn that he's been dead all along, if that makes sense. So I think he changes his greatest regret finally, and is able to pass on into this other afterlife where he stops Rooney Mara's greatest regret, I would assume, the death of her child. And then okay. I don't know where that goes, because I would assume that in her, you know, if what we are told about Isla, the character, throughout the film, that I would assume that that would be her moment in her loop of the afterlife, would be trying to say it would stopping her son from dying, I would assume.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's a weird moment where both of their regrets are stopped, and he seems to are changed, and he seems to remember her for at the split second before fade cut to black. So I don't know. It definitely asks a lot of questions, and it doesn't, I don't think, provide an answer. I don't know if it could.
Yeah.
For what this kind of thing is.
Yeah.
But it's definitely lots of feels and thoughts that it brings about. You may remember the end of The One I Love more clearly than I, but doesn't it kind of end on the exact same note?
It ends on a very similar note, yeah.
Basically, yeah, where he's not sure.
Yeah, he's not sure if Elizabeth Moss is actually
his wife,
or it was the new wife. I think I feel like that movie ends on a much more definitive answer, because you know, it's the way that movie ends. And it's been a few years since I've seen it, but what I remember is that there's a recurring bit throughout that movie where Elizabeth Moss doesn't like bacon, like she just doesn't like it, and Mark Duplass does, and he gets so I'm gonna. I guess I should say the premise of The One I Love, because it's a very weird premise, and I feel,
yeah.
If you haven't seen it, I'm going to tell you what the premise of The One I Love is. Basically, in that movie, Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss play this couple who are kind of having marital problems, but they go on this couple's retreat to this cabin, and in the cabin, they find doppelganger versions of themselves.
Right.
And they're both also played by Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, and they kind of both represent the idealized version that the other person wants their partner to be. And so In that movie, like, you see Mark Duplass kind of bonding with the fake Elizabeth Moss, and Elizabeth Moss bonding with the fake Mark Duplass. You know, as the movie goes on, like, they start to get at each other's throats and, like, get angry at each other, and, like, there's a lot of tension between those two couples. And you don't really know, like, it kind of leaves towards the end where you don't really know. Mark Duplass kind of makes a break and leaves the cabin, and he takes Elizabeth Moss with him, but you don't really know which one he took.
Right.
But then at the very end of that movie, Elizabeth Moss asks if he wants bacon, and the real Elizabeth Moss did not like bacon and didn't make bacon very
right.
often, and the fake one, the idealized version of Elizabeth Moss, did, and so when she asks him that, he kind of gives this, like, what?
Gives like a Spielberg face.
Yeah, and then the movie cuts to credits. And yeah, so it kind of ends in a very similar note, but I feel like that's a much more definitive, like, he probably took the fake Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah. I couldn't remember the exact ending. I knew it was something along those lines of he didn't know which version he brought back with him.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I feel like that one is kind of more like Inception, where it's kind of asking you whether he's in real life or if he's in a dream, but like more definitively, he's probably still in real life, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Because I feel like just the text of that movie Inception, like it does leave it open for interpretation, but like the way the top moves and all that stuff, like it's probably in real life. I feel like we're just going to talk about all the ambiguous endings in this episode. And, you know, did the planet really blow up in Planet of the Apes, Mike? Well,
we'll never know.
While we're at it. But anyway, yes. Yeah, so otherwise, I mean, other things about this movie, I did want to point out a nice little bit of foreshadowing in this movie, because Lacey does murder Rooney Mara at the end of the movie, and earlier in the movie she's having a conversation with somebody and he's like, she's advocating for murder over here.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. She's literally, yeah, I forgot, I didn't even put that together.
And as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, she's gonna kill somebody. That's good.
Yeah. That's good. She says you know, how they justify killing themselves because they don't die, they just go to a different place. How long until someone uses that on another person?
Yeah.
That's literally what she says. I didn't kill her. I relocated her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and nice. I feel like there was a lot more to explore in this premise. And I feel like at this point, like, you know, you have this insane premise with such huge implications for what that premise allows. And then you spend most of the movie in this one house. You don't really see a ton of the outside world. And so that was a little bit disappointing to me, because I feel like there's so much more to unravel with that idea. But at the same time, I feel like I'm liking this movie more and more as we're talking about it and how we're arguing over the interpretation of the ending. It is a good movie. I did enjoy it. Again, not quite as good as the one I love. And I was a little bit taken aback by how bleak this movie was, I feel like. Because the one I love is a pretty funny movie. It's a pretty, like, easygoing, like, it gets really insane, but it is overall like a pretty entertaining and funny movie. And this one is definitely, like, there is humor in this, but it's a lot bleaker and a lot drier.
Yeah, the one I love is like a really dark romantic comedy for most of its runtime.
Yeah.
This is decidedly not that.
But I'm pretty psyched that Charlie McDowell has got a chance to make this movie. And I hope to see more from him in the future. He's actually, you know, he's the son of Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. Which is why Mary Steenburgen's in the opening scene of this movie, I would imagine.
Really?
Yeah, and Ted Danson's in The One I Love.
There you go.
So there's that. But yeah, any other thoughts about The Discovery, Mike, before you wrap this up?
I think that, like you said, even though it may not be satisfying in the most particular way, I think it does go to really bold places. It asks really bold questions. The performances are really great. I think it's well written. It does lack a little stuff, like you said. There's this kind of like cult undertone vibe thing going on at the house that we never really explore in any meaningful way.
Yeah.
But I still enjoyed it. I still am glad that I saw this movie. It asks, it allows you to think about or ask these kind of dark questions that you probably would avoid normally about mortality and all that stuff. So I think definitely people should check it out. I'm glad, like you said, that it is given a chance on Netflix. So hopefully we get to see more cool stuff like this. And Charlie McDowell is definitely someone I'm going to be keeping an ear out for the more of his movies.
Yeah, definitely. So, all right, that about wraps up this new episode of Film Bookcast. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, you can find our games posted at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. You can also find me on crookedscoreboard.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's pre-show. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks where we are shifting gears, my man, because we're going to be discussing the latest masterpiece in the Fast and Furious franchise.
God damn it.
The Fate of the Fucking Furious, man. I am so pumped for Fate of the Furious. I actually rewatched Fast 5, Fast 6, and Furious 7. This past week, and man, those movies still hold up. You know, I gotta say, I watched them for the first time right before Furious 7 came out. Like, I went through that whole series. We talked about this on the podcast back when that movie came out.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the first, like, I liked the first one, but I really love Fast 5, 6, and 7. And I would like to go back and rewatch 2 through 4 to see if they're, like, retroactively better because of the newer movies. They're probably not, but, like, I feel not. Like, at the same time, like, I feel like I'm attached to these characters now and I can still enjoy it a little bit more. But, you know, I really, like, that movie, Furious 7, I loved so much. And I think rewatching them, I think Fast 5 may be a better movie. Like, I feel like it's structurally more sound and it has a better overall story and it's a lot more engaging. Like, it feels like it's a lot more even. But at the same, Furious 7 is my favorite, though. It's so much fucking fun.
Yeah, Furious 7 is amazing.
Yeah, the set pieces in that movie are next level insane. And the Fate of the Furious looks like it's continuing that trend. I don't know if you saw the trailer, but there's a fucking submarine in the Arctic. What are they doing in the Arctic, Mike? I don't know.
We'll never know.
Until 2 weeks from now when we see the movie. So I'm pretty stoked for that. You can look out for that. It's basically the complete opposite of a movie like The Discovery. And yeah, that's correct. Okay. We can like two different things. And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're going to be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in 2001's Christmas Carol, the movie, which will probably be much worse than both The Discovery and Fate of the Furious.
I would assume so.
I would imagine. But, you know, it'll be interesting to watch. I think Nicolas Cage is only in, like, 4 minutes of that movie, so it's going to be a slog. And that hasn't happened in a while. You know, we haven't had a movie where Nicolas Cage is only, like, in a little bit. Remember when we watched Never on Tuesday for that 30-second Nicolas Cage cameo?
Or Fast Times at Ridgemont High for the one scene that he's in the background of.
At least that's a good movie, though.
At least that, yeah, you're right. That is a good movie, at least.
Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. We are out. Netflix all day, Netflix all night. You say you want to watch it, we can watch it all night now. Netflix all day, Netflix all night. You say you want to watch it, we can watch it all night now. Netflix all day, Netflix all night. You say you want to watch it, we can watch it all night now. Netflix all day, Netflix all night. You say you want to watch it, we can watch it all night now. Okay.